Pod Save America is brought to you by Verizon. Hey, we have a business. And boy.
Thriving.
And thank goodness it's not up to us that there are professionals around.
Yeah, thank God there's
we
other
need
people
the professionals.
They're very good, yeah.
Whether you own a small business, are scaling one, or starting one from scratch, you need Verizon Small Business Days. From April 22nd through April 28th, you can partner with Verizon business experts for small business support. During Verizon Small Business Days, you can receive a free tech check with one-on-one meetings with a Verizon business expert. Plus, Verizon business experts will provide you with personalized advice and solutions that are tailored to your specific small business needs. I picture a Verizon business expert just busting through like the Kool-Aid man.
Okay.
Oh, my Verizon business expert.
Need solutions?
Take advantage of special offers and deals during Verizon Small Business Days and get more for your business. Verizon has your back. Don't miss out. Book an appointment today. Just call 1-800-483-4428 or go to Verizon.com/small business. Verizon.com/small business.
Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm Jon Favreau.
I'm Jon Lovett.
And filling in for Tommy today, we are lucky to have with us in studio the host of NPR's It's Been a Minute, Sam Sanders. Welcome
so
back to the show.
Here. Always great to be here.
It's great to
I have fun you. Here.
We have fun having you. On today's show, the Republican Party passes an official resolution stating that the violent insurrection on January 6th that left multiple people dead and injured was, quote, legitimate political discourse. Mike Pence says Donald Trump is wrong about his ability to overturn the election, and we dive into raging media controversies over Joe Rogan, Jeff Zucker, and John Lovett's interview with Jen Psaki. Maybe the greatest controversy of all.
Yeah. No, it's maybe the greatest controversy of all. One thing, it's been a weekend of podcast apologies, and I just want to add one, which is I referred to Mark Short as Mike Short, and it led to a pretty stupid joke on Love It or Leave It. I would say that given that other podcast hosts have apologized for saying the N-word dozens of times, I don't think it really is that big a deal, but I did want to issue that apology.
Before we get started, some great news. Dan Pfeiffer, one of America's biggest YouTube stars, is back with another season of Political Experts React. In the newest episode, Dan is joined by the Lincoln Project's Stuart Stevens to break down Republican midterm political ads from candidates like Dr. Oz and the MAGA mom to Mallory Staples. To watch, head to Crooked Media's YouTube channel. Also, if you haven't heard, Pod Save America and Love It or Leave It have just announced a ton of live shows this spring and summer.
You bet.
Heading back on the road.
Yep, and we're live every Thursday in LA again at Dynasty Typewriter.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
That's starting
back up. And those are fun live shows.
Those are really fun live shows. Cannot wait. We're going to leave my backyard soon enough.
You're going to want to go to crooked.com/events to get your tickets for all this stuff.
All this stuff.
Pod Save America, Love It or Leave It, the Dynasty Typewriter shows, all of them. All right, let's get to it. I have to admit, when I first saw the New York Times headline, GOP declares January 6th attack legitimate political discourse, I thought there might be some like context missing or like a headline writer got a little out of control.
No.
But here's what the Republican National Committee's formal censure of Representatives Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger actually says. It says that the two Republicans, quote, are participating in a Democrat-led persecution of ordinary citizens engaged in legitimate political discourse, and thus, quote, the Republican National Committee shall immediately cease any and all support of them as members of the Republican Party. Sam, what was your initial reaction to the story? And, like, why did the RNC do this? Why do you think they did this?
Why is anyone still doing this censure business? It doesn't do anything. It doesn't mean anything.
I hereby declare this is
I'm
a document.
I'm going to censure you right now.
Yeah.
You're
oh,
censured,
no, I'm
John.
Censured.
Oh, my
what
God.
I
think, so first reaction was like, oh, yeah, of course. But second reaction was when you read the piece, what was really interesting about the article is the meeting itself felt really bipolar. So the Times said at first in this meeting, this was a GOP winter meeting, all these party leaders came in and condemned the attack. They condemned the attack and the insurrection and Trump's conduct. And then the Times story says, over the course of the meeting, everything shifted, and they went to downplaying it and then denying it and then this censure thing. And so for me, the takeaway is, like, right now in the GOP, if you put 100 Republicans in a room, any room, doesn't matter how they walked in, we know how they walk out. There is a small and loud minority in this party that is in charge of the party. No matter what, and like at no matter what level. And I think it really boils down to just the perverse incentives of national politics right now. All these House members, all these senators, they don't want to get primaried. And that is more important to them than a general because these seats are so predictable in so many cases. They're most worried about an even further right primary. And if that is the case, then they'll always do this, right?
So the you put them in a room and the extremism just like spreads like Omicron. It's just... whether they walk in like that or not, that's how they walk out.
It's the same trajectory they've taken in the past year since the attack, right? Like the first week when it was fresh in everybody's mind, it was a violent insurrection. It was wrong. Every Fox News host was texting Don Jr. to try to get his dad to stop. And then over time, they kind of get on the party line that actually it was just a small group of people, even though the Department of Justice estimates, and I didn't realize how many, 2,000 to 2,500 people went through the Capitol.
Wait, they were in there?
Let me tell you.
And I know this doesn't be said anymore, but let it be 2,500 black people up in the Capitol breaking in.
No,
let it be.
I know.
And just one small note on what they're excusing as legitimate political discourse. A lot of people peed in there.
Wait, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they peed.
I knew they were taking stuff.
There's pee. So I just, they're on the record there too. All right.
I mean, I just, look. So, Rana, our friend Rana Romney McDaniel, she issued a cleanup statement that called the January 6th investigation a Democrat-led persecution of ordinary citizens who engaged in legitimate political discourse that had nothing to do with violence at the Capitol. Here's the thing. As you pointed out, Sam, many hours of negotiation went into this censure.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about it a lot. They pored over the language. No one thought that maybe this could be construed as endorsing violence. They really are going to try to get us to believe that that's not what we meant.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but they're trying to do two things at once. They're trying to seem like a palatable party for typical DC discourse, and they're also still trying to wink and nod to potential primary voters who are insurrectionist sympathizers. That's hard to do.
Yeah, I mean...
Like,
it's just like it. I think, look, it's not like the question facing them was, should we embrace Donald Trump's belief that the election was stolen or not? Right. And we want to wink to all the people in the party, the majority of people in the party who believe that it was stolen. This was the FBI called January 6th an act of domestic terrorism. Right. Dozens and dozens of people were injured. Police officers. They had brain damage. They had, you know, all kinds of horrible injuries. Five people died as a result of this. And you can't just say that was not legitimate political discourse and make that clear.
I just don't get why they said anything.
Well, here's why they could have avoided
this whole plot line.
Exactly.
That's right. You start from, they are, what Cheney and Kinzinger are doing is making them mad. It is making them mad that they are doing this, that they are participating in this. And those feelings must be valid in some way. They must be validated in some way. They must be explained. And they can't be explained for what they are, which is these are two people showing a kind of modicum of integrity. It makes us all exposed as the dirty cops we are. And we dirty cops don't like having these kind of less dirty cops rubbing it in our faces. And so they kind of need to get together and come up with some rationale for why what these Republicans are doing on the committee isn't just wrong because they don't like the politics of it, but wrong for some other reason. So they work really hard to come up with an explanation. Even the corrected version is still a fucking lie. It's all a lie. Like, there are lots of Republicans protesting all across the country. They're protesting against masks. They're protesting against all kinds of things. There's only one that there's a fucking committee looking at. It's the one where several thousand people broke into the Capitol and took things from Nancy Pelosi's desk. And oh, by the way, a bunch of people got hurt and died. So, of course, anything they come up with is a fucking lie. I think they just got a little bit focused. To your point, the insurrection was bad, but we fucking hate these two. I think a lot of the conversation was on the but we hate these two and not enough on the insurrection was bad.
How strong is a national party like the GOP actually in moments like this? This whole statement seems very reactionary.
Yeah.
Trump has taken so much power away from a national party infrastructure anyway. Like... does the GOP matter less now, the national GOP, less now than it ever did before?
Yeah, well, look, I think both national parties
yes.
and their national party committees.
Diminished.
People, their critics always think they have more power than they do. I think the same is true with the Democratic National Committee.
I'm like, there are no back rooms.
People are always arguing about the DNC.
Oh, like, the DNC is getting exactly what they wanted. There's no...
DNC's
have you been
not,
to those conventions?
Yeah, they're not doing anything. Neither is the RNC. It is the base of the party. And by the base of the party, I mean sort of like the right-wing media folks. Who were leading the rest of the party around. But you're right, Lovett. Like, they were so pissed at Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, they had to say something. But also, like, yeah, the idea that the January 6th committee is somehow persecuting people who were just peaceful protesters who never entered the Capitol, who were just outside at the Stop the Steal rally, they're not.
People forget.
They're not dealing with those
people at all.
Before
they went inside the Capitol, there was a noose out there. There was a Confederate flag out there. A lot of them said if they got to Pence or Pelosi, they would do stuff.
Hang Mike Pence. They wanted to hang Mike Pence.
It could have been a lynch mob. Like, not even exaggerating.
But it just was an unsuccessful one.
Yes.
I mean.
Yes.
Like, I will, it's amazing how quickly you forget the feeling of it. Like, I wonder if Rana remembers the video of her fucking uncle running down the hall to get out of the Capitol. There's video of him fucking running and that livid look on Mitt Romney's face sitting in the Senate chamber while one of the insurrectionist seven decided to give some speech defending their indefensible position, the kind of rage in his eyes. Like, a few people on that side haven't lost that. Does that make them great? No. But it makes them better than the fucking scumbags getting together at this meeting.
Well, you know who remembered the video of Mitt Romney running is Mitt Romney. Because he tweeted, shame falls on a party that would censure persons of conscience. Apparently, he also said that he exchanged some texts with Rana over this, though he didn't tell us what they were.
Oh, man. Wait, I got three dots from Uncle Mitt. Oh, fuck.
What emoji does he send to her?
I was going
to
say.
What emoji? Upside down smiley.
He just sent her the thumbs down. He did the thumbs down reaction emoji on his statement. Other Republicans who condemned the censure included Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, Chris Christie, Lisa Murkowski. I saw Susan Collins today, Todd Young, a couple of them. I didn't see too many. How important do you think it is to get every elected Republican on record about this?
Most people don't know about this story.
Yeah.
Right? I think people who are really plugged in are following what the GOP at the national level is saying. I think folks are going to plug into the midterms a few months before the midterms, and they're going to be probably not going back to what happened this week with the statement.
So very unusual for me to disconnect from the news at all. I was at a wedding all since Thursday.
Yeah.
And I, like, the few times I just scrolled through Twitter to see what was going on, I was like, legitimate political discourse? What's going on? And it really wasn't until yesterday I dug into it. I'm like, no. This really happened? So yeah, I was one of those people.
Yeah.
And I'm an avid news consumer.
Yeah.
Lovett, the question is, like, we have debated to what extent Democrats should make January 6th an issue in the midterms and beyond. Like, how, if at all, should the RNC resolution change the party's thinking about this, knowing that, you know, as Sam just said, probably a lot of people don't know the story and people are going to tune in, you know, a couple months before November.
I really have been stuck on the fact that the UK has been trapped in a kind of government shaking scandal over a party from over a year ago.
Because in part because of the
sort of attention it's gotten from the media, but also concentration on it from people trying to make it a story. One lesson I would take from what's happening right now is, I think, like, sometimes we've debated on this podcast, right? Like, well, is this the best thing? We obviously think it's the right thing to do to point out the kind of incredibly dangerous authoritarian tendencies of the Republican Party. But, like, when we're at our most mercenary, we ask, like, is this the right way to make sure we're in a position to win the election? I would say that it's because we have the January 6th committee that it has stirred up enough noise and news and interest and coverage that it has kind of caused these kind of knock-on effects of Trump issuing these statements, of stories now about document retention, of Chris Christie and Pence giving these competing speeches, of a censure resolution coming out of the RNC. And all of a sudden, this story now is kind of, it's self-perpetuating, at least for a few days, because it's Republicans talking to each other about this incredibly important divide inside the Republican Party, which is, should America be a democracy, yes or no? So my lesson is only that it does seem as though concerted attention from Democrats on this issue has stirred something up that is even bigger than what the committee could have done on its own.
I agree. But I also think that the kind of slow burn of a story that you get from this insurrection panel committee is not the kind of story that national news media knows how to do well with, or that Democrats know how to do well with. Like, it's a slow trickle of these really damning details about what happened that day and before that altogether make a pretty strong argument. But it's not being delivered in one simple package on a given day. And it's like, will the Democratic Party be able to keep tying all of these dots together over time?
Yeah.
No. To say in October, look at all this.
Democrats aren't good at not tying, but...
Well, I was going to say, I think tying all the dots together is a challenge.
And sorry, and saying tying all the dots together, mixed metaphor, whatever. Sorry, but you get it.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. I guess so. But anyway, tying it all together is a challenge. But I would say this. Obviously, we've seen in polls, you can even hear it in focus groups that have been done, people are not, January 6th is not top of mind for a lot of voters. And so it's hard to make it a big deal. It's hard to make anything a big deal that happened in the past and not in the future. I also think it's hard to make a big deal something that doesn't directly affect people's lives, right? Like even a conversation about democratic institutions and what the Republic, all this kind of stuff, it's tough to make real to people. I think what's different here is an endorsement of violence. Like an endorsement of violence is simple to understand. It also has a direct effect on people's lives. Like, do you want a party in control that is endorsing political violence that could come to your town, that could come to you, right? Like, is that really what you want? I mean, Data for Progress polled 4 swing districts and found that voters overwhelmingly disapproved of what happened at the Capitol, obviously. But in no swing district did more than 15% of likely voters approve of the insurrection, and in all of the districts, at least 80% disapproved. Like,
When you ask that kind of question in a poll, you're also led to answer the right answer.
You're led, yeah. Although in the same poll, they'll say things like, "Yeah, the election was stolen," right? Or "Yeah, Trump's big lie was right." Like the one that got the most disapproval was obviously violence. And you're right; people can say different things about that. But I do think Democrats making the point based on this, and again, you have to keep saying this over and over and over again, that this party has now endorsed political violence. And this part, all the mayhem that you've seen in January 6th, don't just leave it in the past. It's actually about what could happen if they return to power or if they don't get their way. And that's a big problem. That's why you want to keep
it. It's harder to do that when Trump is not there.
It is harder to do that. Well, that's why, but that's going back to the original question I had asked. Like, I do think that's why every single Republican, elected Republican and Republican running for office in 2022 should be made to answer that question. They should be made to answer their question at campaign events, at debates, wherever. And that's why you're seeing so many, I think, today already disavow it. And not just the usual suspects, but a lot of, like, because they know that that's
not good politics.
It's not good politics.
It's not good politics.
It's horrific, but it's also not good politics.
And they want it behind them, right? They don't want to be dealing with this indefinitely.
That's right. One prominent Republican who made some headlines about January 6th over the weekend was former Vice President Mike Pence, who said for the first time that Donald Trump is wrong, that Pence had the legal authority to overturn the election, and that the Republican Party should accept the outcome and move on. Though he still wouldn't say that Trump lost, or he still wouldn't reject the big lie. This unsurprisingly enraged Trump, who called Pence, quote, an automatic conveyor belt for the old crow Mitch McConnell.
Old crow. I'm sorry.
It's old crow is so weird. It's it just never stops being weird. It doesn't work. He's stuck with it. First of all, the like triangulating on fascism is amazing. Like finding a third. There's a third way. Amazing. But also like Trump's statement really muted, actually. Like really soft.
I hadn't noticed that at first, just because I was so focused on the conveyor belt for the old crow that I hadn't realized that. Yeah,
it's a visual, right there. Yeah, I'm imagining crow Mitch.
It's not personal. It's not. He doesn't once again urge his followers to kill Mike Pence, which had previously been one of his go-tos. So, pretty muted. And obviously, it's because Trump has some loyalty and a trick. No, he's really worried that Mike Pence is a person out there with story to tell.
Well, yeah, the story was him got killed, right? Like they would have killed him. He knew that.
He knew that.
I just don't understand.
No, I think he knows it's a story to tell. And back to what we were just saying, he knows deep down that it is bad politics.
Does he want to run for president again at some point? Yeah. Like, is that what he's trying to figure out?
A lot of the reporting says that he does. I can't. I mean,
this was a speech. This speech was read like someone saying, "And therefore, I'm not running for president. Huh. I'm going to tell the truth in this very specific and direct way."
Really? You thought that's?
Who knows?
That's interesting.
Look, I just see all the rest of them. Like, I don't. Ron DeSantis is a smart guy. Marco Rubio thinks he's a smart guy. These are both people choosing to avoid touching this, to avoid saying emphatically one way or the other because they want to leave their options open. Mike Pence has done the exact same thing for 6 years now, and this is the first time he chooses to be this emphatic about something so central to Donald Trump's view of 2020 and 2024.
Why is he even making speeches then?
It went further than he needed to go.
And if I'm Mike Pence and you and like my colleague almost got me killed, day after, I'm out, meanest, most withering statement, and then I'll never speak to you about you ever again.
That's what
I'm done.
Go if you're going to never run for president again. Go all the way. Don't triangulate fascism if you're going to run for president again.
They tried to kill me. They did not. Goodbye to you all.
In his mind, he still thinks there's like some space to carve out between Liz Cheney and Donald Trump, I don't think
that
that's space.
I mean, he's never been very good at politics. I mean, he was vice president
Occam's
because
razor.
He was about to lose the Indiana governor's race. So he like jumped onto this thing because he thought losing as vice president would be better losing at the top of the ticket. And lo and behold, he almost get 4 years later, he's almost hung at the Capitol. Life's funny.
So a group of bipartisan lawmakers is still working on a bill to reform the Electoral Count Act in an effort to prevent future attempted coups. And over the weekend, Joe Manchin and Lisa Murkowski did a joint interview where Manchin said the bill would, quote, absolutely pass. What do we know about what specific changes they're looking to make?
I mean, the first thing we know is be careful what you believe from Joe Manchin.
Yeah, exactly.
For that. But for starters, the bill would clarify that the vice president has no power to reject the state's electors. Wow, great.
Yeah,
low baseline.
Huge step forward.
Yeah, and the measure would also ensure that state houses cannot appoint electors after Election Day in an attempt to change the results. There's some other stuff, and I'm reading from the Times now and I see CNN. There'd be a timeline for states to complete challenges to results of elections, a clear method to certify the results, even a format for transporting the Electoral College certifications to Capitol Hill, and like stage directions on how the day of the actual thing should go. So, I mean, all of it seems pretty common sense, and I guess it could pass, but when I read it all together, I'm like, that's a low baseline. And like, how dare anyone up there pat themselves on the back for passing that?
Yeah. I mean, well, here, I will say a lot of the Republicans who sound like they may support it, like Marco Rubio, were saying something like, well, if Kamala Harris is VP, we don't want her to have the power to overturn the election, right? So the whole, like, clarifying the VP's role thing does seem like the lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
That they can all agree on. If they just do that, I'm like, eh. The thing you mentioned about ensuring that state legislatures can't appoint electors after Election Day, I think that's big.
And it might not pass.
Well, that was going to say. So the things you just mentioned, Sam, that were from that Time story, that was in the draft legislative text from Dick Durbin and Amy Klobuchar and Angus King. And they're in like their own separate group. And then there's like the Murkowski Manchin Republican group. Now, it does say that those groups have started talking. I think if the Klobuchar King, that bill, if all that stuff gets into the overall bill and that passes, I think it's not nearly as good as voting rights passing, but that's going to do a lot to protect against the next coup. It really is.
The fact that we have to say that, protect against
well,
the
we
next
need to protect
coup.
It. We do need to protect against it.
We're through the looking
we
glass.
Need to protect yes. against, but we need to do that. We need to do that.
No, really. Yeah.
And like we have Democrats for a year combined vote suppression with overturning of elections in a way that I think was really harmful. We completely lost on the ability to pass something on voting rights. That is not happening now. But we have this one chance to possibly pass something to like shore up against potential, against a future Trump run. Like, of course we should take it. It does nothing to hurt us. It can only help clarify. I mean, what Manchin said is right. You know, Trump issued this statement the other day saying, well, if they need to pass something to change the rules, it means that my statement was correct, right? Like, if you're changing the rules to stop Mike Pence from overturning the election, sure sounds like it could, which is why they're talking about it in terms of clarifying, what have you. All of this, though, in the end, is playing in, like, very kind of, like, first order constitutional questions, which will ultimately land before a Supreme Court. Regardless, none of this ultimately will stop Republicans from breaking the rules, pretending the Constitution says whatever they want to put whoever they want in power. So the most important protection is winning some fucking elections. But barring that, it would be great to have some kind of a break from what happened in 2020, some kind of a procedure or set of rules that tells Republicans they don't have the power to overturn the election if they so choose. Because and part of the reason I think it's possible that it's going to pass is a lot of these Republicans don't want to think they have that power. They would like to not feel the pressure from the base to overturn these elections. So, like, whatever they can do, do it.
It's the Kamala stay home bill. Kamala, don't show up that day.
Yeah,
no gavel for you.
Well, then, look, I think any bill that's worth passing has to do something about the real danger, which is that the state legislatures, mostly these Republican state legislatures, decide to just appoint the red slate of electors. Like, if it can handle that, I think it's definitely worth passing. If
it doesn't handle that,
if it's just like, if it's
just the Kamala stay home bill.
If it's just the Kamala stay home bill.
Come on.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. When we come back, we will talk about the various raging media controversies.
Sure.
All right, there have been quite a few media stories dominating the news, which we're going to talk about since we have a real live journalist with us today.
Allegedly.
I mean, we're certainly not. So let's start with the controversy over Joe Rogan, who hosts a podcast that averages nearly 11 million listeners per episode, which led Spotify to pay $100 million for the exclusive rights to host the show on its platform.
Is that V1 or V2?
Oh, man, that's an inside, a fucking inside joke. All right. A few weeks ago, 270 health professionals signed a letter asking Spotify to moderate misinformation on its platform, specifically related to Rogan's stance on COVID vaccines. He's discouraged young people from getting vaccinated, incorrectly claimed that vaccines are gene therapy, and hosted hardcore anti-vaxxers who spread so many lies they've been kicked off Twitter. Spotify said it would include a, quote, content advisory on Rogan's episodes about COVID, and Rogan said he would try harder to interview guests with different opinions. Then, over the weekend, Spotify confirmed that it had removed about 70 episodes of the Joe Rogan Experience, not because of COVID misinformation, but because the singer India Arie shared a supercut of all the times Rogan has used the N-word on his show. Rogan apologized, and Spotify said that it would invest $100 million towards music and audio from historically marginalized groups.
I just won't believe that.
Just so, what a classic corporate thing. Though their CEO
also come find me.
Right. Though their CEO also said, quote, "I do not believe that silencing Joe is the answer. Canceling voices is a slippery slope." Meanwhile, artists Neil Young and Joni Mitchell have pulled their music from Spotify, while podcasters Brene Brown and Roxane Gay have stopped putting their shows on the platform. What a mess. Let's start with Spotify. They claim to be just a platform, not a publisher with editorial control. What's their responsibility here? Love it.
Well, look, here's the thing. Also, by the way, one thing they have said in all their statements is that Joe Rogan decided to take down the episodes, right?
Because very careful.
They're not in charge of what's on Joe Rogan's feed there. Look, Spotify paid Joe Rogan $100 million to silence him on Apple, to silence him on Google, to silence him in every single place they could except for one. All right. So they're really just one. There's really just one left for them to do to get the final value out of their 100 million. But all that aside, like, I don't, this idea like, oh, we're not a publisher. Everybody wants to have a party. Nobody wants to clean up. You paid somebody a lot of money to make content for you. They are doing it. I think part of the reason they're a little bit fucked is they can't claim like, oh, we're not going to pay him this. We had no idea he was saying the N-word all the time, because these were just living in his feed that they were fully available to everybody for years. The other thing I will say to defend Joe Rogan is it's a different time. You know, look, 2014, he was just a young man in his mid-40s. People didn't know then. All right. A lot has changed.
Sam, what do you think?
I think my first thought was India Arie. Good to hear from her. Hope she's doing well. Love that album. Really did. Secondly, I think that like a lot of this argument we tried to have before and then we just didn't have it. A few years ago, there was a whole, is Facebook a publisher or a platform conversation? And eventually we just moved on and Facebook is still crazy. And Facebook is still full of conspiracy theory. And I think that like if Spotify had any business sense about all of this, they would understand that the life cycle of internet outrage is extremely short. And if you just shut up we'll move on to something else. They started talking. Then they began to pull episodes down. They're keeping this story alive. They're keeping the story alive, and I don't know why they're doing that. I also feel like there's a larger conversation to have besides should Spotify have these things up or not. Don't expect goodness from corporations. They're corporations, and unless the government makes them be better, they won't be better, period, right? The larger conversation is why does a guy like Joe Rogan have this big of a contract and this many listeners for that show?
Yeah.
It's not a good show. It's not scientifically informed. It's not even really factual. And the larger issue here is that, like, so many Americans increasingly don't trust actual news outlets. They don't trust national news outlets, and they don't think that we, because I'm one of them, are being truthful with them. The latest numbers from Pew Research Center show that nationwide, only 58% of U.S. adults trust national news media. And when you just go to Republicans, it's like 35 or 30% trust. And so in that context, of course.
I think those are even higher than the ones.
Probably.
But like, Gallup had it even worse. Yeah. I mean, that, it's really bad.
But like in that context, of course, a Joe Rogan succeeds. And so we can have a conversation about, you know, what kind of company Spotify is. But there's a larger information conversation to have about who Americans trust and who they don't. And who fills the gap? And I think instead of national news organizations like mine and others having conversations about how we rebuild trust, we got to talk about the saga of Jeff Zucker, you know?
Which we are going to get.
Yeah. And so, like, I am not mad at Spotify because why would it benefit me to be mad at a company? It's a company. It's a company.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think that Spotify is bullshit here, right? That, like, they... Look, the reason they're trying to get away with this is that they are both a platform and a publisher, right? So the way that Spotify works is there are some podcasts that are just on Spotify because it's like a platform. Our podcast is one of them. Your podcast is one of them, right? And then Spotify goes out and picks and chooses which podcasts they want to make exclusive bids for and pay a lot of money to.
Yeah.
And that's what they did with Joe Rogan, like you said, Lovett. They decided to make sure he couldn't be heard on any other platform but theirs. That's not the case with a lot of most podcasts, right? So they, of course, they have responsibility for this, right? But beyond that, I think the question you raise, Sam, is the right one, which is like, what should be done about Joe Rogan? And specifically, what should be done about the misinformation and disinformation that is coming from the Joe Rogan podcast? Because if Spotify kicked Joe Rogan off tomorrow, Joe Rogan would go on any number of other platforms.
That's the tip of the iceberg. Have you seen YouTube?
Rumble, a Canadian version of YouTube that's now aligned with Trump, offered Rogan $100 million just today to come onto their platform, right? He'd go on YouTube. He'd go on play. So, like, the misinformation and different disinformation does not stop.
Thank you.
If Spotify kicks Joe Rogan off the platform, which is why I actually think that, like, when it was just the COVID disinformation that was the story, Rogan said, oh, well, I want to have differing voices on that disagree
with
me.
And I got an answer for that.
Right. But
because
I actually think that that's the best. Look, is that a surefire way? Is that going to work? I have no fucking idea. But we have to do something to expose some of the people who are listening to that podcast to competing forms of information.
I'm going to push back on that.
Okay.
Because I think that, like, it's really easy for someone like Joe Rogan to do the whole, I didn't know, I'm just a dumb comedian. I don't pre-interview. I don't fact check. I just talk.
Oh, yeah.
And instead of saying, I'll do a better job about fact checking and pre-interviewing and booking and being thoughtful about these conversations, or maybe even cutting out the bad parts in post before you post it, instead of saying any of those things, he says, well, I'll just have some other voices. That is so lazy.
Oh, I agree.
It
with
is
that.
So
oh,
lazy.
No, I agree.
And it's
agree
so
that.
Disrespectful.
Of course it is.
To people who are actually trying to credibly inform the public.
But he's not.
And
only to be that.
No, but when you have a platform that big, you have some of that. And
sure,
I think
no,
that
of course.
Like, and I think that like only a certain kind of man can get away with that foolishness. Y'all put a show together. I put a show together. We are in pre-production. We are fact-checking. We are editing script before it runs. We're going to listen to it two or three times just before we put it up. And, like, you do that because, like, you know that when people are listening to you, you have a responsibility. And so it doesn't matter if Joe Rogan says he's a comedian or this or that. At that point, when you're getting that much money and talking to that many people, just do better.
Oh, I agree.
Sorry, not to fuss at y'all about this, but it just burns me up.
But I agree with that. I agree with that 100%. But, like, Joe Rogan is a lazy, irresponsible asshole. Of course. he exists and he's got 11 million listeners.
Yes.
And
yes.
I have encountered a lot of people who come up to us and say, oh, I listen to Pod Save America. I listen to Joe Rogan. Sometimes I believe what you guys say. Sometimes he has other points. Sometimes I listen to Ben Shapiro. I hate Donald Trump. I hate the Republican Party. I don't like the Democrats either. There is a group of people like this that I do think we have to contest and that we have to try to persuade. Fuck Joe Rogan. Forget about Joe Rogan. It's not about him. It's not about Spotify, right? It is about who is that misinformation and disinformation reaching, and how do we fight that? Is the answer just, you know, throwing good information on top of bad information?
That didn't
not
work.
Necessarily, right? But we have to figure out, like, we are in a fight to persuade people, and I don't know that we can count on Joe Rogan acting responsible.
Well, I don't think I'm in a fight to persuade people. My fight is to inform people.
That is,
and I think...
You're right. Well, we have a different... Yes, I'm fighting to actually persuade people. But.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, no. Look, for good and for ill, Joe Rogan is not producing a new show. You know, you point out these studies that say X number of people don't trust the news. That's absolutely true. The vast majority of people, by definition, if you have 70% of people saying they mistrust mainstream news, a lot of those people are distrusting something they are not consuming. Right? These are people answering a question about content they are not imbibing, right? The biggest divide in this country is not between people who is really between people who are engaged in following and paying attention to the news and the tens of millions of people, the majority of the country, who are not. Joe Rogan has a big audience of people that are probably more in that category.
No, I understand, but like,
and my, so all I'm saying is I don't even know why we're not even disagreeing. I agree completely, but like what you're saying is I want Joe Rogan to be held to the standards of the news.
No, I want him to do a little bit better.
Right, of course.
And I also want the news to do a better job of appealing to more people.
How do you think that? How do you think they do
that? I don't know, but I know that for a long time, especially during the pandemic, it became hard to listen to or watch or read most mainstream national news because the spirit behind every headline and every story was like, aren't you panicked? Aren't you worried? You're going to die. This is bad. This is bad. This is bad. And there are studies about the tone and tenor of national news coverage. Most of it at this point is anxiety-inducing and negative.
Yeah, totally.
And so that, I think, needs to be addressed. Are we making a product that is informative and not depressing? Are we making a product that is informative that can, like, at least start to stand a little bit head-to-head with, like, all of the entertainment and disinformation swill that exists?
I mean, you've touched on something, which is a lot of reporters will say, well, the reason that there's distrust in media is for purely partisan reasons. So, you know, Republicans don't trust media because they think it's liberal. And, you know, Democrats will have complaints about media because they think it's, you know, not tough enough on Republicans, right? And I think... You know, and there probably needs more study on this, but I think the point you just made, which is that so much of the media...
It's bringing you down.
It feeds you anxiety.
It makes you nervous.
And it's treating politics like a game and a sport, and it's making everything afraid and stuff like that. That gets to the distrust that a lot of people feel as well. And people like Joe Rogan are saying...
I'm not
going
to make you nervous.
I'm not
going
to make you nervous. Trust me. And I don't have all the answers. And this guy came on my show and he's saying crazy shit. Maybe he's wrong. Maybe he's right. Who knows?
This is also not a lot of what Joe Rogan is doing on that show isn't also that new. Like, yes, we are now discussing the tons of racism that's been on that show. We're talking about the misinformation that's on that show. But there's always been an audience for a certain kind of like white male, very masculine, bro-y conversation around a table in which some days it's somebody like Fauci, some days it's a famous comedian, some days it's a UFO expert. There's been like Howard Stern did that. There's lots of shows that have done that. And I think that the conversation, like, how do we get more people to pay attention to the news? Fine. There is millions and millions of guys out there that find that kind of conversation appealing. And like, the answer to telling them en masse, like, you're wrong to like what you're liking. Like, it's true. Like, I think what Joe Rogan's doing is pretty gross. But like, I really am much more interested in like, how do we peel some of those people off? Like, how do we make something that reaches them, that kind of touches that kind of community, that like conversation, without it having to be infested with the kind of toxic qualities that we see in sort of the Rogan universe?
Or even some of the toxic qualities that we see in mainstream news.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
If
especially.
There is a way to make national news appeal to more people and oppress them less, I think we should do that.
Ugh.
I think there are studies after studies about the way that all major newsrooms covered the pandemic. It was unnecessarily negative. That's clear. There's a recent episode of the Freakonomics podcast that spends a whole hour talking about why is U.S. media so negative right now? And these are real questions that have to be asked, because as long as the news feels like a chore and it's making you sad, fewer people are going to listen to it. And I think more people need to listen to the news and not to Joe Rogan.
And I do think, too, part of this, some of this comes down to, like, what it means to respect speech, right? And I think there's a kind of argument from their side that's like, we respect the power of speech, and therefore we don't want to see any hindrances. We want to say whatever we want, whenever we want. We want to pay no consequences for saying something racist. We want to pay no consequences for spreading misinformation, because the most important thing is individuals having the power, whatever that power means to them, to spread. And what we're basically saying is, like, bad ideas have incredible power, right? You have incredible responsibility that comes with your ability to spread those bad ideas in far-reaching ways. Like, if you, it is a big difference between telling somebody, like, there's a, I just sometimes imagine Joe Rogan having one of these anti-COVID, one of these anti-vaccine guests on. Just imagine going from person to person to share that information, like handing it out like a pamphlet. Like, have you heard, like, it's killing teenagers? Have you heard natural immunity is stronger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you imagine, like, telling this to people, telling 11 million people something completely false individually, I think gets at just how hard, how bad it is to do it on mass.
Well, I also think that the controversies over these stories play into the polarization. So, like, just preparing for this podcast, I was like, I want to find out exactly what the COVID misinformation was and disinformation that Joe Rogan was spreading. And I'm Googling and stuff like that. And Joe Rogan, Spotify, all you get is stories about the controversy. And yeah. I'm like, it took me a while to
find
out
the actual thing
what
that he
the
said.
Actual thing he said was. Because yes. I'm like, so what is that actually doing for the cause of making sure more people trust the vaccines, which should be our goal?
I feel the same way about this whole conversation that I'm being pulled into over what I think about Joe Rogan saying the N-word. Don't ask me. Stop. Let's not. The larger issue is that never in the history of media has anybody other than a white guy like Joe Rogan got a deal as big as Joe Rogan.
Right.
You know? And so the N-word is secondary to me. And I'm also tired of these other comedians circling the wagons acting like Joe Rogan saying the N-word is like the last frontier of free speech. Well, we got to let comedians tell hard truths. That ain't a hard truth. That's the low-hanging fruit.
Well, that's another thing, too, is that it also gets, again, the controversy gets distilled to, well, he said the N-word. Did he say it because he was talking about other people saying, what was the context? He's made comments about how black and white people have different genetics. He had a guest on who claimed that black people have a gene that makes them predisposed to violence. It went beyond him just being saying the word because someone else said it.
Also, at this point, if you tell me that any white person said the N-word, I'd be like, oh, I bet they do when we aren't around. I'm not surprised. I'm sorry. Like, I don't have any space for surprise for that anymore. Don't have any space for surprise for it.
It's also like, you know, horrible things with Jordan Peterson about trans people and how they represent the harbinger of the end of civilization. He said the N-word dozens of times. There is something so, like, it is not surprising to me that these things are kind of offenses that get you, is this okay? You know, like, if it was 70 times Joe Rogan talked about kikes controlling the media, right? Like, it'd be a very different conversation.
Yeah.
One other point I wanted to make on the misinformation side of it. I mean, I also understand, given how bad the coverage has been, the pull of finding some expert, some guru, some person, some Sherpa to follow who can break it all down. Because, I mean, like, you know, you and I think at the height of the pandemic became as close to scientists as we'll ever be in our whole lives. And I remember vividly telling, I said this to Ronan, almost verbatim. He sent some story about some new information we were learning, I believe about Delta. And he was like, look at this. It looks like it's more dangerous in this way than we thought. And I was like, you can't fucking trust that. That is misinformation. He's like, it's Reuters. And I was like, I'm telling you, you can't trust anything. You got to read the fucking studies. Because I was like, at that point, I felt so kind of like manhandled and misled by even the most anodyne and basic and straightforward news coverage of COVID.
I have a child who can't get vaccinated, and I pay more attention to COVID than almost anything, and read from experts who are like, who would never be on Joe Rogan's show, right? And then the amount of conflicting information over the last several months it will drive you crazy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I follow this stuff, and the headline, I mean, the experts are one thing, the headlines, like, millions more children are dying. Should you be scared and not leave the house? You know, it's just that kind of tone.
I'm still hurt over Fauci telling me for months to not wear a mask and saying, you better get one real quick.
Right.
I'm still reeling over that.
And this is a person who is good faith, trying to do his best, been an expert forever.
Yes.
And so, like, you're right, love it. When people hear some Sherpa on a podcast that says they know it all, and they're like, well, I might as well believe that person because all the other people are leading me astray as well. Lack of trust in institutions is at the core of this problem.
This. And everything and it ain't
else we're
about
doing,
Joe Rogan
we're just
saying
dancing
the N-word.
Around it.
Let me tell you, I was an undergrad when the number one song for 12 weeks was Kanye West's Gold Digger. All these white folks are saying the N-word. It's not new to me. It's not surprising to me. And it's just like distractionary.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's been like a few moments. It was like, that's it. I'm not reading anything else except Dr. Ashish Jha's Twitter. That's it. I'm done. Just Dr. Jha and me. That's the only thing. Just me and him in conversation.
And then that poor guy tweets some stuff and everyone's yelling at him about something. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. He's just the dean of public health at Brown.
I'm still stuck on Joe Rogan said the N-word. The sky is blue. Come on. But okay, on that point though, go ahead.
I just like, I just think also, is once the first round of this is probably is going to be a controversy came up months and months and months months ago, put three interns on listening to what's in the fucking archive.
You can't pay those interns enough. Oh my God.
Yeah, Spotify really did a serious vet on that one.
What I'm worried about, or not worried about, just wondering about, like, app silent in this entire conversation is advertisers on Joe Rogan's podcast. Usually when this stuff flares up in TV or cable news, there's a push for the advertisers to pull ads from Tucker Carlson or whoever, and eventually some do. From what I understand, no advertisers have pulled their ads from Rogan's show, and none of them have even really spoken about it. What's up with that? I don't know.
So, and I don't know this because I don't listen to Joe Rogan's podcast, but is part of the exclusive deal with Spotify that you don't have to listen to ads because Spotify, it's just subscriber-based?
He still reads them. So people will pay for Spotify to have Joe Rogan read. And when you buy a Spotify Joe Rogan ad package, they also, I think, make you buy in other Spotify shows.
That is interesting.
I would just say, you know, look, there are podcasts where you'll hear the N-word zero times, and there are podcasts where you hear the N-word from one to a million times. And I think you just think about which ones you want to put the ads in.
I almost used the N-word once on my show, and they were like, no. And I was like, you're right. Like, I don't even, like, just, like, it's really simple to have a standard.
Obviously, you know, we hope that that media makes itself more responsible, but I don't know if that can happen without Jeff Zucker. And we do need to talk about how he is the one media titan who did get canceled last week. He resigned after failing to report a consensual relationship with one of his longtime colleagues, which is against CNN's internal policies and came to light as a result.
And it's like, okay, I mean, I guess Wolf and I never had the conversation, but I thought we were excited.
So this came to light. Jeff Zucker's relationship came to light as a result of the network's investigation into former anchor Chris Cuomo, who was fired after using his sources to help his brother, then Governor Andrew Cuomo, respond to allegations of sexual misconduct. Talk about a butterfly effect, man.
Which I want to point out started because they were worried Ronan Farrow might publish a story about Andrew Cuomo. So a call from Ronan about a potential story led Chris to try to track down who else might be talking and looking.
For Ronan now?
Well, I'm just saying it leads all the way up. I'm just saying.
Does Ronan not have enough?
I just think it's amazing that he's just sitting on the couch playing video games and just canceling people left and right.
I don't think Zucker's canceled. I think he'll end up on Puck News.
Oh, he's
going to
be fine.
Oh, Puck News.
He's going to Puck.
He's going to be fine. I don't know if
I couldn't give a puck.
Zucker will be fine. I don't know if CNN's, you know, anchors or employees will be. They spent the days following Zucker's departure offering impassioned tributes to their former boss. Here's a clip.
Inside CNN, this was a week like no other. The sudden removal of CNN boss Jeff Zucker has rattled this news outlet to its core. This is the ugliest shakeup at CNN since the days Ted Turner was still walking the halls. Zucker was in charge one minute and he was gone the next, so why?
It's been a really tough day today and a tough few days for us here at CNN, all week really. I didn't want to talk about it until tonight. So the truth is that we're all heartbroken because we lost our leader here. We lost the man who was the backbone, the glue, and the spirit of this company. The man who I personally credit with changing my life, a man who believed in me when nobody else did.
So thank you, Jeff Zucker, for everything you did for everyone at this network and for what you did to the entire country, for the entire country.
Sam, everything you were just saying about voice and tone of media that caused people to distrust it was like,
I'm turning that
we didn't
off.
Even plan that, was like encapsulated in those clips.
Not since Bernard Shaw was under a desk in Baghdad.
Also, let me tell you something that happens in legacy newsrooms all the time. CEO turnover. It happens a lot.
There's a lot to unpack here.
Look, invented putting Trump's empty podium on CNN until Trump showed up. Take that away from him.
Like, okay. There's the whole thing about, like, you know, should he have been fired because of a consensual
relationship?
I'm going
to stop you right there and say yes, because the two of them were in charge of a lot. And she was working under him. If there's any even sense that their relationship meant that her department
she was getting promoted or anything like that. That's not fair.
And I'm surprised that she still gets to stay.
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't know there's rumors that another shoe might drop.
Who else was he messing with?
No. She was also former communications director to Andrew Cuomo. So were they involved in helping with the Cuomo stuff too? I don't know. Again, we don't know all this kind of stuff. And they're also were the Discovery Warner Media titans trying to push him out and they use this as an excuse? Was it Chris Cuomo's attention? So all of this. Whatever.
Follow the money, cool bono.
Whatever. This is all sort of internal stuff that I don't actually think is a big, story in the national interest. But I am the CNN employees, right? And look, you love your boss. Your boss leaves. I get it. But sort of the public, I don't know over this is a lot.
My boss.
Someone wrote Sarah Jones in New York Magazine wrote a piece that was just like, hey, CNN, everyone calm down, was the headline. I was just like, yeah, that's sort of how I feel right now.
I think stepping back from this, I think there's a kind of navel-gazing.
Yeah,
navel-gazing. In the mainstream media that is sometimes a bit smug and sanctimonious.
That's a nice way
and just
to put
out
it.
Of touch with what people are actually worried about.
They're trying to get their kids back in school. They want to get their young kids vaccinated. They're worried about inflation.
And they turn on
Can
CNN
I
and Don
Lemon's
home? Crying about his
and
boss.
And then it's come on now. And
Stelter's calling it
like, Zucker will never
happening?
Be broke. He'll never be broke.
What are we
He'll be
doing?
Fine.
It's just Jeff Zucker.
It is about the perspective, huh? It's like, what are we covering today?
Also. And Parker Malloy wrote a piece about this in her excellent newsletter about just reminding everyone about some of Zucker's quotes in Jonathan Mahler's 2017 profile of him for the New York Times Magazine, in which Zucker said, the idea that politics is sport is undeniable, and we understand that and approached it that way. Let me tell you, that is a huge fucking reason Americans have record low trust in the media, because politics is treated as sport. And then he said, as Zucker sees it, his pro-Trump panelists on CNN are not just spokespeople for a worldview. They are, quote, characters in a drama.
That's what it was.
That's what we were talking about.
Characters in a drama.
Characters in a drama.
That was.
Yeah, I'm turning on Joe Rogan at that point. Come on now.
And I just whatever. I get it. Some of these people work with Jeff Zucker. They liked him. They thought he was good as whatever. But that view of what news should be, where he was a guy that helped make Trump in the first place and then turned on Trump because that was a more interesting story.
Yeah. But you know what's really frustrating? I know a lot of CNN journalists. When I covered 2016, I was on the road on the same buses and the same gaggles with CNN journalists who on the ground are literally trying to do the Lord's work.
Yes.
And the bulk of the newsroom of these institutions, not just CNN, they are in it for the right reasons. They believe in it. They are not served by that approach to journalism. And it's just I don't know. There needs to be a big old come to Jesus meeting because, what are we doing if this is what's happening?
And I do think there is a difference, even with the anchors and the folks on air, there's a difference in the journalism that you see from Jake Tapper and Dana Bash and Caitlin Collins and people like that. And then, you know, the monologues that you used to get from Chris Cuomo or Don Lemon.
Remember their pass-offs?
Or fucking Jim Acosta. It's a little... People can tell.
Yeah.
It's a little much.
Yeah. It's a little bit... It's newsroomy. And I say that as someone with very firsthand experience on the creation of the newsroom. I did... Then there's a kind of like the newsroom made cable news seem more serious. And then a bunch of people watch the newsroom and now they're playing out their own version of everyone's doing good night and good luck every single fucking night. Hello. It's unbelievable.
How long until Jeff Zucker's new media startup partners with Joe Rogan?
Okay. Well, I didn't know until I read Parker's newsletter that Jeff Zucker was, instrumental in the rise
fear factor.
Of Joe Rogan. Yeah,
Fear Factor
and The Apprentice.
Come on.
It all connects. All right, finally, a media scandal that hits very close to home. A few weeks ago on this very podcast, our own John Lovett asked former Obama colleague and current White House press secretary Jen Psaki about how she handles annoyingly dumb questions from Fox News correspondent Peter Doocy, including a recent attempt to make Biden seem like he doesn't care about crime. Here's how Jen answered.
You know, I am not here to work for Peter Doocy or Fox, but I will say if you look at how it's portrayed and how my answers are portrayed, even when I say, no, we don't think crime is good, and here's all the things we've done, including the thing that makes, makes Republicans crazy, just anecdotally by the hate tweets I get on Twitter when I say this, is that they voted against funding for local cops programs because of the American Rescue Plan. Also that Biden has supported $300 billion more in funding. And at the same time, he also thinks we need police reform. It's like they don't know what to do with that. But every time we say that, it makes them crazy. I think it speaks to, if you look at Fox on a daily basis, I mean, do you remember the four boxes that we had on all the TVs, right? Mm-hmm. Which is on my TV right now. So right now, just to give you a sense. So CNN, Pentagon, as many as 8,500 US troops on heightened alert. Okay, true. Same on MSNBC. CNBC is doing their own thing about the market. And then on Fox is Jeanine Pirro talking about soft on crime consequences. I mean, what does that even mean, right? So there's an alternate universe on some coverage. What's scary about it is a lot of people watch that and they think that the president isn't doing anything to address people's safety in New York, and that couldn't be farther than the truth or other places.
And here's just a small taste of what Fox did to that answer over the last week.
Jen Psaki laughed about, quote, soft on crime policies and said those are in an alternate universe. Well, Jen, we're not in an alternate universe. You are.
Jen, are you so locked up in your ivory tower that you have no idea what Americans really care about and what they're concerned about?
That's Jen Psaki's position. You'd have to be delusional to think crime was a problem in this country.
Now you see Peppermint Patty dismissing crime because, well, she hates the messenger too.
Love it. What do you have to say for yourself? Talk about navel gazing. We decided to really end with a
I had no idea that this interview had blown up so much because I'm in my own information bubble.
Same.
Well, all of it's on Leading. We're on Tucker. We're on the Five. Amazing.
You made the Five.
We made the Five.
It's just amazing that Jen's whole point in the answer. Well, she started by talking about how crime is a real issue. They didn't just take her out of context. They made her make the opposite point of what she was trying to make.
You know, it speaks to something that ties all these conversations together, which is all across our media, there are crafty, innovative people trying to find ways to make money, taking advantage of the mistrust people feel. And very, very few people making money by trying to rebuild that trust. Lots of people talking about the trust issues, not a lot of money in it right now. But then there's a lot of people trying to figure out ways to kind of like, how can we exploit the fact that they assume that the Democrats are soft on crime? How can we exploit the fact that they're never going to listen to the actual episode so we can just take this out? How can we exploit the fact that they don't trust CNN or don't trust the New York Times when we talk about COVID? How can we take advantage of this? End of thought.
I mean, if you're Jen or the White House, like, how do you handle shit like this? What do you do? You go fact check it, and then the Washington Post fact checked it. Great. How many people saw the fact check?
Yeah. Yeah. It's what they do. I remember there was a documentary about Fox years ago, and they talked about how for years at every morning meeting, there was like the Jesse Jackson portion of the morning meeting. Like, what do we got on him today? We got to beat up on Jesse today. What are we doing? Like, this is like just what Fox News does. They're going to find something to whip.
Yeah.
Right?
And this is, that's also an example of just like the playing field here is not level. And I'm not just talking about the playing field between conservative media and progressive media. It's conservative media versus progressive media and mainstream media that's
and
not supposed to, that's trying
I
not to
say have it's a for-profit media versus non-profit media. I know I'm biased,
yeah.
But
well, and like exactly, especially if you're a non-profit media, like you don't have the resources to fight that.
Yeah.
And you know, and on our side, we have a lot of liberal millionaires and billionaires who will donate money to all kinds of causes except for, you know, actually kind of create a progressive media infrastructure.
Well, because they're cosmopolitan moderates, right? They find Trump distasteful. They're pro-gay, they're pro-women's rights, but when push comes to shove, that's not where their heart is in. Here's the other thing I would say about this too, which is I think a lot of times Democrats get into these intra-democratic arguments because Democrats, you know, you argue with people who argue back in good faith. Mm. You tend to pick your fights with people who are willing to kind of come back at you. And there have been multiple news cycles about who's responsible for our messaging problem? Who's responsible for our losses in this election? Is it the progressives? Is it the moderates? Was Terry McAuliffe lose because he was a Clintonite? Or was it the schools? Or what? There was nothing wrong with what Jen Psaki said on this show. There was nothing even remotely distasteful about it. Nothing whatsoever.
She didn't screw up. She'd make a gaffe. She'd make a mistake.
There was nothing.
She didn't tell me to go kickboxing.
And yet for a day, it was exploited to drive home the message that Democrats are soft on crime and Democrats want to abolish the police.
Because it's a political operation. Because Fox News is a political operation.
And the problem is the problem. It's not what some random activist says about crime. It's not it's not Jen Psaki not exercising message discipline. She's incredibly disciplined. It's not the disputes within the Democratic Party on policy, which gets nowhere near what happens on Fox. There is a giant corporate-backed machine designed to make Democrats look evil, feckless, and stupid, and we do not have the equivalent on our side. Half the media says Washington is fucked. The other half says Democrats are fucked, and we wonder why we can't win elections. The problem is the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't. Well, also, they're all shameless there, right? So if you're running a very well-tuned political machine, political operation, and you are shameless and you don't mind just driving home the same message every day, like that's how people have won campaigns forever. Fox News has been running a campaign ever since they've been around.
You bet.
And that's how they do it right there. It's not like magic. All you have to do is shameless and repeat the same message.
Every day they have their morning meeting and then you march down into the mausoleum and you get your orders from Roger Ailes' fucking head. And that's that.
You think his head's there?
Yeah, I think he's calling the shots.
On that note.
The only thing that I can take away from this whole conversation is that the way to fight back against all of this is to go stream NDRE.
That's
on
right.
Repeat on Spotify for the rest of the week.
There's only one
she
hero
needs
in this
win.
Entire conversation.
NDRE.
And it's NDRE.
We love her.
And I also...
She's not the average girl from your video. One of her songs.
Wasn't there a moment of poignancy when she said she was surprised by the attention she had gotten for sharing this information? It was like, how dare we? As it make her feel that way.
Yeah. India deserves nothing but flowers. Nothing but streams.
Thank you, India, and thank you, Sam Sanders, for joining us today.
So great to be
a
here.
A wonderful conversation. Come back anytime.
Thank you. Support your nonprofit newsroom of your choosing, listeners.
We're sort of progressive, sustainable media companies trying their fucking best.
All right, music, play us out.
Yeah. Oh, wow, it's a 501c3.
Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our senior producer is Andy Gardner-Bernstein. Our producer is Haley Muse, and Olivia Martinez is our associate producer. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to Tanya Sominator, Sandy Gerard, Hallie Kiefer, Madison Hallman, and Justine Howe for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Milo Kim, and Amelia Montooth. Our episodes are uploaded as videos at youtube.com/crookedmedia.
In the 1970s, a young group of violent revolutionaries joined forces to create the Weather Underground organization. a group of radicals who brawled with police officers and bombed the Pentagon, all in the name of ending racism. Hi, I'm Zaid Ayers-Dorn, host of Crooked Media's new podcast, Mother Country Radicals, which dives into the true story of how my parents and their friends went from peace-loving activists to topping the FBI's most wanted list. New episodes of Mother Country Radicals are out every Thursday. Listen and subscribe wherever you get podcasts.